Hello, it is Wednesday, June 17th. Welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Andrew Jung. President Lee Jae-myung is in the French town of Evian-le-Bain for the Group of Seven summit. More on that on today's news briefing. In our in-depth news analysis segment, we'll talk more about the ongoing fallout from the unprecedented shortage of ballots that interfered with voting during nationwide local elections on June 3rd. Plus, literary translator G.S. Hand will be joining us on this week's Korea Book Club segment to talk about the book A Plague Sea by Kim Bo-young. Korea 24 starts now.
Excellent. Thank you.
Hello, my friend. How are you?
I'm good.
President Lee Jae-myung is in the French town of Evian-le-Bain for the Group of Seven summit, having joined the talks as a guest on Tuesday along with the leaders of India, Brazil, and Kenya. During a photo session, Lee also had a brief encounter with U.S. President Donald Trump and asked him to make efforts to resolve North Korea issues. For more on the summit and other major headlines of the day, we have in the studio Deputy Editor-in-Chief of KBS World English News Service, Kim In-kyung, with us. Hello, In-kyung.
Hello, Andrew.
There was a lot of attention here in Seoul over whether President Lee would have a chance to speak with U.S. President Donald Trump at the G7, especially as speculation is rising that Trump's next diplomatic project could be North Korea now that he has sealed a framework agreement on the war in Iran. In-kyung, what happened?
Well, they had a brief encounter while taking group photos on Tuesday. As state leaders gathered for a photo op, he asked Trump to spearhead a peaceful resolution of North Korea issues, quote, just as he resolved the Middle East war. According to the presidential office, Trump responded with a promise to make efforts to settle the North Korea issue. As you know, last week, Trump posted a photo of himself and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un taken 8 years ago during their first summit in Singapore. There was no accompanying comment, but it sparked speculation that Trump was signaling interest in reviving diplomacy with North Korea.
Tell us about Lee's other sessions at the G7.
At the first extended session at the summit, he discussed advances in AI technology and called for the benefits of those advances to be shared among all countries. On the sidelines of the event, he held talks with his Canadian and German counterparts. During his meeting with Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney, he said South Korea, as a powerhouse in the defense industry, was prepared to actively contribute toward Canada's push to reinforce its security capacity. That meeting came as South Korea is bidding for a massive submarine project to replace the Royal Canadian Navy's aging fleet. He similarly discussed defense cooperation with German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, with Lee proposing collaboration in areas such as joint research and development, joint production, and expansion into third country markets.
After taking part in expanded sessions and other events through Wednesday, Lee is expected to return from his European tour on Thursday. What's the news here in Seoul is who will welcome him at the airport when he returns? In-kyung, can you explain?
Sure. Send-off and welcome events are very formal and highly publicized in South Korea, and who shows up is micro-analyzed by the media. When Lee departed for Europe last Tuesday, Prime Minister Kim Min-seok attended the send-off event, but not Democratic Party leader Jeong Chung-nae. This was highly unusual because it has been customary for ruling party leaders to see off the president on overseas trips. This sparked talk that Lee is backing Kim as the party's next chairman, as they are widely seen as potential rivals in the race for the party's next leadership. The Democratic Party convention will be held in just 2 months. The presidential office said today that when Lee returns, both Kim and Jung will welcome the president.
Let's now move to the ballot shortage protest, which is in its 13th day. Protesters continue to surround the handball stadium in Seoul's Songpa district, which was used as a ballot counting center. We briefly delved into this issue yesterday, but this has created problems for athletes. In-kyung, what can you tell us?
The demonstrators say they are blocking access to the stadium to make sure no one tampers with ballot boxes which are still inside. But the handball gymnasium houses 9 sports associations, including for fencing, handball, and mountaineering. Fencing association officials tried to get inside the stadium on Tuesday to retrieve gear for members of the national team ahead of 2026 Senior Asian Fencing Championships in India, which start later this week. Lawmakers from the People Power Party tried to persuade the protesters to allow the athletes to go inside, But one adamant protester refused to budge. So Olympic gold medalist Oh Sang-wook and other fencers had to leave for the event without the equipment. They had to borrow swords and other gear for the competition. If the lockdown stays in place, it'll likely disrupt athletes planning to attend upcoming events like the Finn Swimming Championship in Incheon and the Women's Junior World Handball Championship in China later this month.
In other headlines, Seoul Mayor Oh Se-hoon attended the final hearing in his trial for alleged violations of the Political Funds Act. What sentence is the special counsel seeking?
The special counsel requested a prison term of 1 year and 6 months and a forfeiture of 33 million won, or about $22,000. Oh was indicted without detention in December on allegations that he obtained the results of 10 opinion polls from power broker Myung Tae-kyun ahead of the 2021 Seoul mayoral by-election and had his longtime supporter Kim Han-jung pay the 33 million won fee. Prosecutors said Oh circumvented regulations governing political funds and damaged public trust in the rule of law. Oh denies the charges. If he's sentenced to a fine of 1 million won or more, he will automatically lose his position. The court will hand down its verdict on July 22nd.
Moving on, the Defense Ministry plans to ease land use restrictions along the inter-Korean border as part of deregulatory efforts to promote coexistence between civilians and the military. In-kyung, can you tell us more?
Sure. This can sound a bit tricky, so please bear with me. The military demarcation line is the land border that separates the two Koreas. Under that line, South Korea has designated a civilian control line, which lies within 10 kilometers south of the MDL. The space between the MDL and the CCL is called the Controlled Protection Zone, and development activities here are strictly prohibited. Under the Controlled Protection Line, Protection Zone is the restricted protection zone where construction and land development projects are possible with the proper authorization. Starting next year, the Defense Ministry plans to adjust the civilian control line northward by an average of 2 kilometers. This means some of the controlled protection zone will be reclassified as the restricted protection zone. The new restricted protection zone will cover about 270 square kilometers, or for those familiar with Seoul's Yeouido district, 90 times the size of Yeouido. The ministry will also seek to adjust the existing restricted protection zones within 25 kilometers south of the MDL, starting the latter half of the year, and to lift all restrictions on land use for an area about 450 square kilometers, or 150 times the size of Yeouido.
Finally, in economic news, the Bank of Korea released a report warning of high inflation. Can you give us the details?
The BOK said consumer inflation averaged 2.4% in the first half of this year, exceeding its 2% target. It predicted that inflation is going to be even higher in the second half of the year at around 3% because of higher global oil prices following the outbreak of the Iran war in late February. The BOK said inflationary pressures remain significant despite progress in efforts to end the Iran war. It warned that stronger consumption and rising wages could keep inflationary pressures elevated even if the Middle East conflict ends and oil prices fall. The central bank said it expects core inflation, which excludes food and energy prices, to stay in the mid to upper 2% range in the second half of the year. In a press conference later in the day, BOK Governor Shin Hyun-sung said he expects consumer prices to continue climbing at a high rate for quite some time, despite the recent drop in global oil prices. He said he expects it'll take some time for global oil prices to stabilize and that higher wages at some IT companies could raise inflationary pressure by influencing wage trends in other industries. But he ruled out a big step rate hike of 50 basis points at one go.
That's all for today's news briefing. Thank you, In-kyung.
Thank you, Andrew.
I'm Baritone Tae-han Kim, winner of the Queen Elizabeth competition. You're now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
We'll be right back.
You're hearing chants from Tuesday's protest outside the handball stadium in Seoul's Songpa district that was used as a ballot counting center, where the participants are calling for a rerun of the June 3rd local elections. It's been now 2 weeks since the June 3rd elections. Those elections were marred by a shortage of ballots that delayed, undermined, and otherwise interfered with a fundamental right in any democracy, the right to vote. Protests expressing outrage at the shortage of ballots have been continuing since the elections on June 3rd. According to the National Election Commission, 91 voting centers ran out of ballot papers on Election Day, and as a result, voting was temporarily halted at 26 of those polling stations nationwide. And of those 26, 15 of those were in the Songpa district, where protesters have been gathered around the handball stadium for the second week, calling for a rerun of the local elections. To tell us more about this issue and what is happening at the protests, joining us on the line is Rafael Rashid, a freelance reporter whose works have been published in The Guardian and The New York Times, among other publications, and who has visited some of the protest sites himself. Thank you for joining, Rafael.
Thank you for having me.
Before we talk about all the problems that have been born from this disaster, give our listeners a rundown of what happened on Election Day, June 3rd, and the why and the how of what created this shortage of ballots in the first place.
Sure. I think you did quite a good recap there. But I think, you know, South Korea, as you said, held nationwide local elections on June 3rd. For mayors, governors, city councillors across the country. But from around 1 p.m. that afternoon, something went terribly wrong in certain parts of Seoul, particularly in the Songpa district, as you pointed out. Polling stations simply ran out of ballot papers. The National Election Commission later confirmed that 91 of the voting centers had run short. And again, 26 of them had to be temporarily suspended entirely. 15 of those were in the Songpa district. The worst single case was a polling station in the Jamsil area, which had received fewer than half the ballots it needed for its registered voters. And people queued for hours. Some gave up and went home, and others were handed waiting tickets and told to come back. I guess the simple version, the simple reason of why this happened is that they essentially did not anticipate so many people would come out to vote, and they didn't have enough papers in certain areas.
Mm. So people were voting after the 6 p.m. deadline. I guess a few people might say, well, if you got to go vote, what's the big deal? But it is a big deal, partly because there might be legal ramifications. What legal issues does this have, Rafael?
Yeah, so under South Korean election law, polls close technically at 6 p.m., but the Election Commission did make an emergency decision to extend voting at affected stations for anyone who had received a queue ticket before 6 p.m. In some cases, I think they were waiting until midnight. But I guess that created two problems, legal problems. Some voters who had been turned away earlier simply didn't come back. Maybe they had commitments at home, look after the children, who knows, meaning that they were effectively disenfranchised through no fault of their own. And the Election Commission has admitted it cannot even determine exactly how many people were affected. And then I guess another issue, a little bit more delicate, is that by the time some people were still voting late into the night, the television networks were already broadcasting exit polls, kind of voting tallies and whatnot. So that kind of raises the question about whether those still in line had already seen how the election was going, essentially.
So the first being people actually disenfranchised from their right to vote, and then the second issue being people being exposed to broadcasts showing or perhaps telling them who to vote for, in a way. Since election night, though, protesters have refused to leave Seoul Olympic Park, one of the many ballot counting centers set up to count votes. The protesters are, as I understand it, are united in their anger at what happened, but are diverse in what motivated them to come out and, of course, their beliefs on what caused the ballot shortages. Who are these protesters and what are they demanding?
Yeah, I think it's a diverse crowd, to say the least. In the first weekend, the crowds at the Olympic Park were, I think, quite large and quite young, actually, predominantly people in their 20s and 30s, a significant number of women, young couples, families, even with pushchairs. At that point, and I did visit, there weren't really any stages, there weren't really any microphones or formal organizers. People I spoke to simply came out to express real institutional betrayal, not necessarily a belief that the election was stolen, but a feeling that one body responsible for protecting their vote had completely failed them. But alongside that crowd, there was also, from the very beginning, I guess you could categorize as a hard right election denial movement that has been pushing fraud conspiracy theories for years, long before the June 3rd election. And so you had figures like far right YouTubers who actually they were even booed when they arrived to the place. They were not wanted. And some politicians or former politicians came over making claims about Chinese interference. So you had quite a variety of people. You had the Stop the Steal movement who came as well. But I guess as the days and weeks have gone by, the younger civic crowd has largely, I mean, a lot of them have gone back to work or back to school. And I guess a lot of the people remaining there are harder in character. You have American flags, election fraud chants, like we just heard, and demands for international investigations. So quite a mix of people.
So as you nicely outlined, it's a mix. You have the far right conspiracy theorists. You also have the less extremist in terms of where they stand on the spectrum. These people, however, are, of course, angry at what happened. Sports organizations, however, are still being barred from entering the Seoul Olympic Park's handball stadium. Again, this is where the protesters have gathered, and this is, of course, where the ballot counting center is, and or was and still is. These sports officials and athletes who need to use the facility can't go in because these protesters are not letting them in, so they can't do their jobs. This has been going on for almost, I guess, 13 straight days. Rafael, tell us more about the situation in front of the handball stadium, and what are the reasons protesters have barred entrance into this facility in Seoul's Songpa district?
Yeah, the protesters, they believe that the ballot boxes inside the building are essentially evidence of electoral irregularities that must be preserved and not be tampered with. And their physical presence at the gates is intended in a way, I suppose, to prevent anyone from entering and potentially interfering with what they consider, in effect, a crime scene. The problem is that the ballot counting was completed, I think it was on June the 5th, and whatever is inside has already been counted and processed, and legal experts say that there is nothing left to preserve in a meaningful sense that isn't already on official record. But the blockade has continued regardless, and what it has actually achieved is trap the officers of, I think it's around 12 sports bodies based in the building, and staff have been unable to reach their desks for almost 2 weeks. Athletes can't use the facilities as well. And even I think it was the women's junior national handball team showed up to collect training equipment ahead of a world championship, and protesters searched their bags. There was a compromise that had been reached between the two sides, but I think it was just yesterday, a single person stood in front of the gates blocking the way and basically didn't want to budge. So that's been ongoing, and there have been a few scuffles, and police have been involved. And as of today, I think there are still roughly a few hundred people who remain on site.
So a very complicated picture there. People have proposed different remedies to resolve the situation. Some voices have called for redoing the elections altogether. Some have said, let's just redo the elections for the areas that were affected, which would, of course, include the Songpa district in Seoul or parts of it. What is the latest in terms of what the political parties are saying? What is the governing Democratic Party saying? And what is the conservative opposition, the People Power Party, saying?
Yeah, I mean, the two parties are in, I guess, very different places at the moment. Today is the legal deadline for filing election appeals, exactly 14 days after the election, at midnight tonight. And so the People Power Party has confirmed it will file election appeals with the National Election Commission, covering at least six regions where ballot shortages occurred, including Seoul. These appeals basically ask the Election Commission to review whether the shortages materially affected the results. And if the commission comes back and agrees, then that could, in theory, trigger a rerun or reruns. And if it rejects the appeals, then the People Power Party can take the matter to court. The ruling Democratic Party calls the decision self-contradictory, arguing that basically demanding reruns would invalidate perfectly valid votes, and that in turn would trample on the very voting rights the PPP claims to be defending.
The People Power Party, for all intents and purposes, performed poorly in this local election. But it did win in one of the most important areas, that being the Seoul mayor race. The conservative candidate, Oh Se-hoon, won that race. But the party's stance that we need to do a complete rerun of the local elections, as you just nicely described, could imperil that victory. Are there voices within the People Power Party saying that, hey, we might have to take it a little bit easy here because we won in Seoul and we want to preserve that win? Why do an entire rerun or ask for one if we want to, you know, keep this win?
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, it's quite a complex situation when you want to preserve Seoul, but maybe have a rerun elsewhere. And I think there is a lot of kind of differences in opinion within the party. You have the leader, Chang Dong-hyuk, who has explicitly said that his goal is nationwide re-election, which has caused quite a lot of turbulence. Then you have the Seoul mayor, Oh Se-hoon, who, you know, won the race. And if there were a rerun, then he would have to have to go through the process again. And he's come out and he's accused Chang Dong-hyuk of exploiting young people's legitimate anger for political purposes, saying that many people can see this is driven by Chang's unstable position within the party, because there are a lot of people within the party who don't want him to be leader. So the PPP is holding a general assembly of its lawmakers this afternoon to address both the appeals issue and also Zhang's future as a party leader, because some of them want him gone.
The other question within South Korean politics is, what is the presidential office, that is the office of President Lee Jae-myung, saying about this whole situation?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, President Lee Jae-myung has been, I think he's been careful in what he's said, but in a statement shortly after the crisis broke out, he called the shortage of the ballot papers a violation of citizens' constitutional right to vote, and said that an independent body that has lost the trust of the people has no reason to exist. He's been in Europe recently for the G7 summit, and he's also said that private checkpoints and obstructions by the protest sites must be dealt with firmly, drawing a line between essentially legitimate right to protest and also what has been happening at the handball gymnasium, which it would suggest, you know, he sees as unacceptable.
Following this electoral disaster, the National Election Commission chief, Do Tae-ak, resigned. The commission has also apologized for what has happened, but said the ballot shortages do not warrant a redo of the local elections. Can you tell us the latest on the progress of the investigations being conducted by the police and prosecutors on this matter?
Yeah, it's a two-track process. You have a joint prosecution and police investigation team, and they've completed a three-day search of the Election Commission servers, seizing internal messaging records and approval logs. And then from this week, they will begin summoning Election Commission staff for questioning. And they basically want to establish who knew what, when, because it would seem that some people did know that shortages were happening, but apparently nothing was done about it. And the Election Commission itself has also set up its own external fact-finding committee, but those findings have yet to be published.
Again, this is a very murky situation, since we don't have all the facts about what happened and who did what and how and why and when. The Democratic Party and the People Power Party agreed to form a special committee with equal representation from both sides, and with the chairmanship to be held by the opposition People Power Party. The investigation will cover the National Election Commission and regional election commissions, while witnesses will include the Interior Minister, ministry officials, and local government officials from the affected areas. Rafael, tell us more about this other investigation and what that could do.
Yeah, the formal vote to launch the investigation goes to the full National Assembly tomorrow, I believe. So I guess that's the first thing to watch out. The committee will have 18 members in total, and as you mentioned, quite notably, the People Power Party will hold the chairmanship, despite being the smaller party in the National Assembly. Police have been excluded from the investigation scope, which may yet become, I suppose, a contentious issue, given their role, at least in the early days of the crisis, and accusations against police for mishandling protesters. I guess the key question is whether the investigation stays focused on administrative failure and National Election Commission reform, where genuine bipartisan agreement exists, or whether the PPP uses the chairmanship to push, perhaps, we don't know, but perhaps push fraud narrative through the committee. Those are very different investigations. So I think the next 45 days will show which one this actually becomes.
Well, we're hoping for some clarity on the situation for everyone's, betterment. That was Rafael Rashid, a freelance reporter based here in Seoul. Thank you for joining us for today's in-depth news analysis.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 137.64 points, or 1.58%, on Wednesday to close at 8,864.24. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ gained 13.28 points, or 1.3%, to close at 1,031.96. You can check Korean Stock Market Updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets, handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Andrew.
What's our first story?
We begin with an incident that happened during the latest South Korean World Cup squad's training session. A drone was caught spying on the team.
Well, that won't be the first time anyone has tried to get potentially illicit intelligence on a certain team in sports, but give us the details of what exactly transpired.
So ahead of the Group A match against Mexico set for 10 a.m. Friday, Korea Standard Time, the team was getting ready for a 90-minute private training session on Wednesday at the training ground in Zapopan near Guadalajara, Mexico. According to team officials, as the players began warming up, an unauthorized drone was spotted.
I'm suspecting the drone may have surprised the team and everyone there. What actions, though, were taken by security officials at the site, and did they manage to take the drone down?
Well, first of all, the team security personnel detected the aircraft and a Mexican military drone jamming operator stationed at the team's base camp brought it down. Officials from the team, local police, and the military attempted to secure the drone. However, two men believed to be its operators reportedly retrieved it and fled the scene.
So it sounds like some people were prepared, but of course that session, the training session that is for Team Korea, was supposed to be a closed-door training session for the team. Could the drone and what may have been an attempt to spy on the team, could that lead to serious leaks that could affect the outcome?
Well, team officials said the drone was seen hovering and was taken down while the players were getting warmed up. So it was before training involving tactics and strategies commands, so it is highly unlikely any sensitive information was leaked.
So to be sure, for now, there's no telling if it was an attempt by devoted fans to see more of the players or a coordinated espionage operation. What kinds of steps, though, are being taken following this incident?
A FIFA security officer assigned to the squad requested an investigation by Mexican police. The Korea Football Association informed FIFA and sought measures to prevent similar incidents from ever occurring again.
Hoping it doesn't happen again. Now, moving on to our next story. What do you have, Dan?
The most prominent accolade missing from K-pop megaband BTS's collection is a Grammy. The boys have been nominated multiple times but didn't get to nab the award yet. That may change with new categories, namely one on Asian pop music performance set to be introduced.
The Grammy gods have yet to smile on BTS, but you sound like there might be hope finally. How many new categories are we talking about?
So there will be a total of 5 new categories added for the 2027 Grammys to take effect at the 69th Grammy Award Ceremony to be held on February 7th next year. So they are: the Recording Academy announced on Tuesday the Best R&B Collaboration or Duo Group, Best Traditional Pop Vocal Performance, Best Traditional Folk Album, Best Latin Song Categories, and the most significant addition, one that honors Best Asian Pop Music Performance. Together, they bring the total number of awards to 100.
What is this Asian category? Will that boost the chances of BTS getting a Grammy?
Yes, it is the most significant addition that could provide some leverage there. The new category to honor artistic excellence in Asian pop music performances originating from or widely recognized within Asian markets, including K-pop, J-pop, and C-pop, with meaningful use of one or more Asian languages.
So obviously, as this award suggests, this will have an Asian focus. But do we know what prompted the award organizers to add this Asian category?
Well, some K-pop music has been making waves and leaving lasting marks in the music sector. K-pop history was made at this year's Grammys with Golden, the hit song from animated film K-pop Demon Hunters, became the first ever K-pop song to win a Grammy by earning Best Song Written for Visual Media Title. A CEO of Recording Academy, the organization that presents the Grammy Awards, Harvey Mason Jr., said, "Asian pop music is one of the most significant and sustained forces in the global music industry," and emphasized that this is the right moment to create a category that more accurately reflects the genre's scale, artistry, and global impact.
Now to our final story of the day. Dan, what is it?
A KBS-produced YouTube program titled Next Door Families, What Makes a Family, won the Best Original Digital Creation Award at the Monte Carlo Television Festival.
You know, it never hurts to win an award, but what is the significance of this particular award?
So on Tuesday at the 65th Monte Carlo Television Festival held in Monaco, the program became the first to win the award, which was introduced for the first time this year. Quite a historic accomplishment to win the new digital category honor at one of the world's top television awards that sits alongside the greats like the Emmys. The competition is steep, with around 100 countries taking part and sending their entries.
So, which makes all the difference, because the more competitive, the more prestigious this award becomes. But please give us a brief intro of this now award-winning program that earned this award.
So, Next Door Families, What Makes a Family, shares candid stories and perspectives on marriage, childbirth, and parenting from members of diverse forms of family in Korean society in a talk show-style format. It includes a cast of celebrities ranging from a single mother who gave birth via sperm donation to a gay father who adopted his nephew. The award-winning program was produced by the KBS broadcasting team in response to the low birth rate crisis here in Korea.
Introducing folks to the various, I guess, life stories around this, especially those of families, is certainly praiseworthy because it helps tear down, well, not only raise fertility rates, but tear down stereotypes, most of which were unfortunately not so positive. What did the team behind this program have to say after winning the honors?
Producer and director Yoo Kyung-hun said he feels great pride, especially after watching how a program that focused on concerns of Korean society resonated with the rest of the world. The program did receive high praise for helping to look beyond the conventional idea or notion of what a family should be while addressing various challenges families today face. The success of the program also helped validate the expanded role and responsibility of KBS as a public broadcaster by better reaching out to younger demographic and global viewers via the digital platform.
Kudos to the program's producers and everyone involved. But that's all we have for today's edition of Korea Trending. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you so much for having me. We are the champion of
PDA online.
This is two-time Stanley Cup champion Jim Park, the head coach for HL Anyang. You are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
Time now for Korea Book Club, our weekly segment where we dive into the world of Korean literature and books, exploring works either in Korean or English translations. Joining us this week is G.S. Hand, a literary translator and winner of the 53rd Modern Korean Literature Translation Award for Fiction. Hello, G.S. It's nice to see you again.
It's nice to be here.
So, what book are we talking about today?
I want to talk about what I think is the most exciting piece of Korean genre literature being translated into English this year. It's A Plagued Sea by the writer Kim Bo-yong, translated by Sophie Bowman, and it's due out this August. It was originally published in Korean under the title Yeokbyong-e-Bada by the publisher Alma in 2020. This is part of the Lovecraft Reanimate series, which invited Korean writers to reimaginary stories by the writer H.P. Lovecraft. A notable one of those was Yi So-young's book, Come Down to a Lower Place, translated by Janet Hong, which was published earlier this year. The standout of these books, though, is A Plagued Sea, which I think really goes beyond the normal limitations of genre literature to do something much more ambitious, not only by reckoning with H.P. Lovecraft's legacy, but by trying to find a way past it.
So the Korean title is Yeokbyong-e-Bada,
in
English, as nicely translated by Sophie Bowman, A Plagued Sea. As a journalist, I would argue, though, that the shorter is better and that less is more, so I wouldn't put the 150 pages against her. And not suggesting that you are in any way, of course. But G.S., tell us more about our author today, Kim Bo-yong.
Kim Bo-yong is a legend in Korean sci-fi. She was established as a Korean sci-fi writer before the current wave of popularity of the genre. She's had two books published in English, I'm Waiting for You and On the Origin of Species. Another mark of her influence is that she was a script supervisor on Bong Joon-ho's Snowpiercer.
That's an impressive resume. You mentioned, though, that this book is a rewriting of a story by H.P. Lovecraft. For unfamiliar listeners, who is he and how is Kim Bo-yong's book related to his work?
H.P. Lovecraft is one of the inventors of the modern horror genre. He was an American writer born in 1890, influenced by Edgar Allan Poe, among other writers. And he published a lot in the American pulp fiction magazine genre in the early 20th century. He published a group of interconnected short stories, which are known as the Cthulhu Mythos, which involve ancient, unknowable, malevolent gods and cosmic evil. His writing is sometimes referred to as cosmic horror. It imagines mankind as powerless, insignificant specks within a malevolent universe. This book is a rewriting of his story, The Shadow Over Innsmouth, which H.P. Lovecraft published in 1936. The background of that story is that it's about an antiquarian researcher who visits a small seaside village called Innsmouth, where he discovers a terrible secret, a hidden cult of people who live in unnatural communion with monsters from underneath the ocean. This story involves some politics of racial purity, which point to some of the more problematic aspects of H.P. Lovecraft's legacy.
Racial purity is a phrase that will rarely, if ever, spawn positivity in one's mind, but tell us exactly how Lovecraft explores that topic.
Well, H.P. Lovecraft's works often imagine an other who is evil, malevolent, and often subhuman. And it's difficult to tear that away from H.P. Lovecraft's personal life, in which he was openly and violently racist, anti-Semitic, and anti-immigrant. For example, if you look at the letters that Lovecraft wrote when he was living in New York, the descriptions he used for immigrants in his neighborhood are often reminiscent of monsters that he described later in his horror fiction.
Well, I imagine it must have taken some work to address that elephant in the room for Kim Bo-young. How does A Plagued Sea deal with that background?
In A Plagued Sea, the protagonist of Lovecraft's story is reimagined in the form of the researcher Ha U-jin, who's a highly credentialed university figure with connections in government and industry, and comes into the city to study what he sees as an interesting scientific phenomenon. However, the protagonist of A Plagued Sea is named Mu-yong, who's a private bodyguard who happens to pass through the location of the city, a small village called Haewon, on vacation with her young niece. While they're there, there's a volcanic eruption under the ocean, and a mysterious illness begins to spread through the city. The writer has noted that she actually wrote this story before the COVID-19 pandemic, although there are some obvious parallels in the fact of a mysterious illness and pandemic lockdown. However, she stresses that there's no direct connection between the two.
I mean, that really does sound strangely familiar, and I bet our listeners are thinking the same. But how does the rest of the story play out and close the loop on Lovecraft's racist legacy?
When the city of Haewon is shut down because of the pandemic, Mu-yong and her niece Hyun end up living in the city indefinitely, alongside the villagers. One of her acquaintances there is a half-Vietnamese woman named Yoon-hee, who's being abused by her husband. While she's there, she sees the effects of the so-called East Sea disease, which turns the people who suffer from it into something other than human, with smooth, hairless skin, bulging eyes, and eventually even gills. There are also rumors that that villagers are being replaced by inhuman creatures from underneath the ocean. At first, Mu-yong feels horrified and frightened by the creatures she sees in the village. But when she begins to see how Yoon-hee adapts herself to the new world, and in particular when she sees how her niece Hyun is affected by the disease, she starts questioning whether she has to react to what she sees with horror. When she looks at something which she expects to be a monster and sees the face of someone she loves, she has to reckon with whether it's necessary for strangeness to lead to fear. In this way, the story challenges the basic foundations of Lovecraft's work in, I think, a very productive way.
That's a very profound way of delivering that very important message. But who would you recommend this book to?
This is a book that deserves to be widely read. I think there's a chance that it's going to be extremely successful. I hope it is. Speculative fiction readers are going to admire the way it imagines a fully realized world in only 150 pages. Non-genre literature fans are going to find an intellectual and emotional heart to the novel, which is engaging and challenging. And because of the connection to Lovecraft, fans of horror who don't usually read translations are going to find an easy end to the book. Mm. But really, I think everyone should read it. It's a masterpiece.
Well, I am going to too, actually. But that's all for this week's Korea Book Club. We were joined by G.S. Hand, who gave us the great introduction of Kim Bo-young's A Plagued Sea, translated by Sophie Bowman. Thank you, G.S.
Thank you.
And that's where we wrap up our show for today. Again, you can always listen to Korea 24 on various apps, KBS Kong, KBS World Radio, and KBS World Radio on air at 7:10 p.m. Korea Standard Time every weekday. We'll be back tomorrow. I've been your host, Andrew Jung. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
모란이 피기까지는 김영랑.
Until peonies bloom, I 김영랑.
모란이 피기까지는 나는 아직 나의 봄을 기다리고 있을 테요. 모란이 뚝뚝 떨어져 버린 날, 나는 비로소 봄을 여인 서름에 잠길 테요.
Until peonies bloom, I'll just go on waiting for my spring. On days when peonies drop their petals, I'll finally languish in sorrow at the loss of spring.
5월 어느 날, 그 하루 무덥던 날, 떨어져 누운 꽃잎마저 시들어 버리고는 천지에 모라는 자취도 없어지고.
One day in May, that one sultry day, when the fallen petals had all withered away, there was no trace of peonies in all the world.
뻗쳐 오르던 내 보람 서운케 무너졌느니 모란이 지고 말면 그뿐 내 한해는 다 가고 마라.
My soaring sense of fulfillment had crumbled into sorrow. Once peonies have finished falling, my year is over for all 360 days I sadly lament.
360날 한양 섭섭해 우옵니다. 모란이 피기까지는 나는 아직 기다리고 있을 테요. 찬란한 슬픔의 봄을.
Until peonies bloom, I'll just go on waiting for a spring of glorious sorrow.
You've listened to Korean poet Kim Yong-rang's 모란이 피기까지는 Until Peonies Bloom, read by An Jae-woo and translated by Brother Anthony of Tays, An Sun-jae. KBS World Radio brings the beauty of Korean poetry to the world.
KBS World Radio. KBS World Radio.